our students and community members as well. This year's program, titled Israelis and Palestinians, Narratives of Identity and Peace, involved a film series, 6 internationally recognized scholars, 7 courses, and a host of other activities. Sandy Levitt, Assistant Director of the Center for Asian and Pacific Studies, has been at the heart and at the nervous center of our program. Sandy will present recognition to 2 students we celebrate as peacemakers of the present and of the future. But before we hear Sandy's voice, I'd like to thank her for all the thankless tasks that she has performed over the course of the year with grace and efficiency over the last year. Sandy.
On this project. I've learned quite a bit myself and wanted to work with them. And one of the biggest honors for the whole committee has been to work with and help develop the student talent that we have. Over the course of the year, we've worked with closely with a group of students on several projects, starting with workshops that we designed ourselves and evolving into workshops, seminars, and celebrations that they created and hosted themselves. 2 of those were Common Ground, which looked at environmental issues and common bonds between Israelis and Palestinians. And a big celebration was held that reached many, many community members, and that was the Festival of Cultures, to look at Jewish and Muslim dance, music, storytelling, and food. Because of these students, this program will continue next year in the form of Common Ground. The students have taken the initiative to apply for official student group status to continue their efforts this year. And there are 2 students in particular who have been instrumental in their efforts, and we'd like to honor them at this time. The first is Kevin Aaron.
Zahira Kamal and Galia Balan are our Wilberta and Carlton Savage professors of international relations and peace. And they are visionaries and prophets in their own country. For her advocacy of Palestinian rights, Zahira Kamal, who holds the highest office of any woman in the Palestinian Authority, has suffered imprisonment, detainment, and harassment by Israelis. Galia Balan, the noted scholar of political science at Hebrew University and a loyal citizen of Israel, joins her friend Zahira as an indefatigable advocate for Palestinian rights. Professor Golan helped to found Peace Now, the Israeli peace movement, and has suffered the taunts and ridicule of the wrong-headed right and nearly lost her life when in 1984 a bomb exploded at a Peace Now rally. Similarly, Zahira Kamal has been threatened and ostracized by some Palestinians for engaging Israelis in dialogue. Both women represent the forces of reason and reconciliation in Palestinian and Israeli societies. Both women have left indelible marks on their societies and on the peace process. And both women illustrate that it is possible to disagree and remain in relationship, that it is possible for dialogue to produce results. And both women are nationally and internationally recognized. Galia Golan, professor of Soviet and East European Studies in the Department of Political Science at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. She is a 1995 recipient of the New Israel Fund Award. She's a spokesperson for Peace Now, the major peace movement in Israel. She helped to found the Jerusalem Link, an Israeli-Palestinian women's joint venture for peace. As I mentioned, Zahira Kamal is director of the gender planning and development for the Palestinian National Authority. She is program director of the women's development of the UNDP in Jerusalem. She is one of the founding and acting directors of the Palestinian Federation of Women's Action and the director of the Women's Information and Networking Center. So both have credentials, splendid credentials to speak to us this evening about peace and reconciliation. Galia Golan and Zahira Kamal provide us with tangible evidence that hate and violence can yield to dialogue and reason in personal, national, and international affairs. To those who say that dialogue and practitioners of dialogue are naive and that physical force rules the world, Golan and Kamal prove the opposite. The 100 years of periodic armed conflict between Israelis and Palestinians has produced misery and solved few problems. Tonight, you will hear from two internationally respected and recognized scholars, women, and peace activists. Through and with dialogue, they are helping their respective nations and peoples, in the words of the prophet Isaiah, beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Galia Golan, Zahira Kamal, welcome to our campus. We are blessed and honored. Zahira.
Process going on at the moment. It has basically broken down in our part of the world. But what I'd like to talk about is what women have been doing, been trying to do, and what we will be continuing to try to do in our part of the world. There's a generally accepted theory that women are more peaceful than men, that war is connected with men and peace is connected with women. Possibly, theoretically, because women are associated with nurturing, and this is theoretically supposed to make us more peaceful. Our tasks in the family, particularly in dealing with our children, mediating, trying to keep the peace within the family, mediating children's disputes, seeking peace within the family. This is theoretically supposed to give us some appreciation for and experience in peacemaking. There is a theory of Sarah Rubin called maternal thinking, which basically talks about people who raise children, and they can be men as well as women, that is whoever is playing the maternal role, and it usually is, of course, women. People who play this role, take this role, develop certain qualities or certain techniques, and basically their effort is to prevent violence. Prevent violence between their children, towards their children, from their children. And this is supposed to contribute to creating the experience and the techniques for peacemaking. In a sense, this maternal thinking prepares us for working for peace. There are other theories about this. There are biological explanations, theoretically, psychoanalytic explanations, as Carol Gilligan talks about different moral development between boys and girls and men and women. And empirical research has demonstrated that there are differences between men and women. There is a gender gap on issues of violence and on issues of peace.
and in the very interpretations of words such as power and security, very clear differences between men and women in the way in which they interpret these things, the way in which they see them. This research has been done in the United States, in Canada, in Western Europe, and this gender gap has been very clear and increasing over the years. In Israel, we weren't so sure if there was this difference between men and women, because our question was, if you have a society that is engaged in prolonged conflict, wouldn't the socialization of men and women be somewhat different on these questions from socialization in a country such as the United States or Canada or many of the West European countries that have not known conflict of this type for so long? But actually, we do find in Israel that there is something of a gender gap, at least if what is concerned with process, resolving conflict, how to resolve conflict. And there is also a greater tendency for women to participate in peace activities. There's a greater tendency for women, at least those who are active, to be active on the left in peace activities more than those who choose to be active on the right. Doesn't mean that all women are active by any stretch of the imagination, but there is a tendency for women to go more to the left, both in voting and in peace activities, than to go to the right in terms of extra-parliamentary activity. And I might add, as in Europe and the United States, one finds in research that the less religious, more secular, more highly educated, these are people who go towards the left and towards the peace camp. On the other side, those who have greater religiosity, less education, they tend to be towards the right. And this, by the way, is true of men as well as of women. While I'm not totally convinced that women are by nature more peaceful, it is a fact that those who are active today tend more to the peace camp than to the right. And it is also a fact that women have played a large role in the peace camp in Israel, possibly even providing something distinctive. If we look at the beginning of women's peace activism in Israel, that is, women who were working separately or in movements for peace in Israel, we'd have to go back to the 1982 Lebanon War. At this time, in this war, when Israel invaded Lebanon, there was a spontaneous response of mothers of soldiers. Actually, it was parents, but the media called them mothers, and very quickly it became a question of mothers. And it was indeed mostly women who were involved. It was a group called Mothers Against Silence, although the official name was Parents Against Silence. They, like the group of women that had traditionally been organized by communist parties in the past, united and advocated on the basis of motherhood. We, the mothers, want to protect, preserve our sons. This wasn't entirely a gimmick, if it was a gimmick at all. It was a genuine concern for the lives of their sons. But this also came despite the ethos in Israel of serving, of fighting. And it came at this time because the Lebanon War was not a war of necessity. It was not what we call in Israel a war of no choice. We had the perception in the country that previous wars had been thrust upon us, had been wars of no choice. The Lebanon War was not the case. This was the breakdown, the very first time, of the consensus in Israel around a war, because it was, in fact, initiated by Israel. It was an invasion of Lebanon. And I think for this reason, for the first time, you had women coming out, despite the ethos of glory and heroism in the country, and saying no to this war. Glory, heroism, saving the country, protecting the country, these things lost meaning in the Lebanon War, in this war of choice, particularly for those who were the parents and mothers of those who might be killed. Whether it was a tactical device or not, the mother's idea did not attract a great deal of support, did not attract large numbers of women. Those who were active at that time, the women who were active during and against the Lebanon War, did so mainly, primarily in the mixed peace groups. And there, they were very numerous. The women were very numerous, sometimes close to 50% of the activists in these early years of the peace movements. But very generally, for the most part, they were kept in the background. Because in Israel, the peace movement, the major, massive peace movement, has to, or at least the beginning, felt that it had to make an appeal on the grounds of security. To talk to a people engaged in war, to talk to a people who for generations have been struggling, in violent struggle with their neighbors, you have to make your appeal for peace on the basis of security. That is to say, it has to come from people who understand security, who understand the problems of security, of safety. And therefore, the peace movement, perhaps the only peace movement in the world that was born this way, the peace movement had to come out of male combatants. And indeed, the peace movement in Israel was founded by 348 reserve officers and soldiers from combat units, so that they had the authority to speak. They had the loyalty that was above all reproach and the authority to speak about peace. And so even though there were women, at least one woman officer amongst these 340, the original 350, the woman was not permitted to sign her name to the open letter to the government which established the movement, because the whole idea was to present men, that is, people who understood security, and they were calling for the government to take steps towards peace. Similar thing happened in the Lebanon War. A small group called Yesh Gvul, there is a border, there is a limit, a group of people who were refusing to serve in the Lebanon War, and later, years later, refusing to serve in the occupied territories. They, too, were men, and men alone, because, again, it was the idea, we are the ones who are fighting, we are the ones in combat, we are the ones who have a right and the knowledge to call for peace. And so there, too, women were simply excluded. Over the years, I think the situation changed somewhat, and women became much larger part and a much more visible part of the peace movement. But basically, the most significant change occurred during the Intifada, during the Palestinian uprising that began in December 1987. With the Intifada in the occupied territories, we saw a spurt, an outburst in a sense, of women's peace activism in Israel. And for the first time, we saw genuine peace groups that were women's peace groups and women alone. An amazing number of groups sprung up in Israel, mixed groups as well, but also, as I say, for the first time, women's, purely women's groups, exclusively women, if you will. The most famous of these was Women in Black, though it was not the largest of the women's protest groups. There was something of the mother's code in the weekly vigils of mourning that the Women in Black conducted around the country. But they didn't consciously use the mother motif or slogan. They, even though they were imitating the mothers in Argentina. Actually, aside from one group, that is another group of parents who were then called mothers against violence, aside from that group, basically there were no groups amongst these new women's protest organizations, there were none which used the mother angle or the mother code or the mother ethos, even tactically. Rather, these groups raised their voice in protest to the occupation. Their protest to the government of Israel, to the way in which the government of Israel was responding to the Palestinian Intifada, and in favor of peace and compromise. We've tried to understand just what it was that galvanized women at this time in response to the Intifada, when it wasn't so much our sons. In fact, it wasn't our sons who were being killed, more for the most part, during the Intifada. And a number of explanations seem to be possible. Some say that it was the result of the development of the feminist movement in Israel. The fact that women had reached a certain consciousness and self-confidence in Israel, sufficient to speak out as women. And indeed, a new feature of these groups was the participation of well-known feminists, and in some cases also women of the lesbian community, who for the first time became active in peace affairs. Yet in interviews and studies that we conducted on these groups, most of the members of these purely women's protest groups said that they were not feminists, including the women in black, even though I would say many of them were, if not most of them. A second explanation was that women chose to act or to create exclusively women's groups because they felt that their voice was not being heard in the mixed peace groups. The classic example was a small group called the Year 21. This was a very small group that broke off from Peace Now during the Intifada. They wanted more radical action, more immediate action. And almost everybody in this small group were women. Just about everybody were women. But those who appeared to the media, those who gave the speeches, those who led the group were the two men out of all of the women who were active in the group. In any case, for them, presumably, a mixed group did not permit them to be heard. Yet the Intifada saw an outburst not only of these women's groups, but of a tremendous rise in the number of women who were active in the mixed groups. Women flocked to the mixed groups, and in fact reached a point where maybe 50% of the people active in the mixed groups, and in Peace Now in particular, were women, and 50% of the leadership were women in the mixed groups. So that it's hard to say that it wasn't possible for women to feel comfortable or have their voices heard in the mixed groups. So while it is true, I think, that women might have found it more comfortable, easier to act in exclusively women's groups, they might have been more willing to speak up and more able to take an active role in a purely women's female framework, I think the explanation nonetheless lies elsewhere for women's activism during the Intifada. I think the Intifada spoke to women, provoked women in a different way. The Intifada was a civilian uprising by the Palestinians, conducted primarily by women and children fighting Israeli soldiers. This was not our usual war with tanks and aircraft out on a battlefield. This was direct civilians in their villages, in the streets, often in our own streets too, threatening our personal security. I believe what occurred was an identification with the Palestinian demonstrator. And it may be that this identification went deeper, not just identification with civilians resisting an army, but an identification of women with the oppressed. The Intifada, this Palestinian battle for freedom from occupation, struck in us, I believe, a chord where we could understand and identify with the struggle of the oppressed, of the powerless. And as women, we could identify with this state of powerlessness and oppression. I'm not saying this was conscious, but it was a link between feminism and peace activism, whether in separate groups, women's groups, or in women's participation in the mixed groups. I can speak for myself, I think, because for 20 years I've been active in Peace Now, which is, of course, a mixed group. And at the same time, I was one of the founders of a women's peace group, originally called Reshet, today the Israeli component of the Jerusalem Link, this group of Israeli and Palestinian women working for peace. And I'm a longtime feminist. If I speak for myself, I sought activism in a women's peace group, not because I felt secondary or ineffective or uncomfortable in a mixed group. And I never reduced my activity at any time in the mixed group in Peace Now. But I sought to create a women's peace organization for two reasons. The first is I wanted to create a space and a means for women's voices. to those previously silent to be heard. It was my experience that women did not speak up, often were not listened to in women in mixed groups. At public meetings, at rallies, at parlor meetings, in dialogue with Palestinians, or in disputes with politicians and so forth, women either didn't speak up if there were men around, or they weren't listened to. Women would and did become engaged when they were in a safe environment amongst other women, sometimes the wives of leading Israelis, and all kinds of women. These women found their voice, and it was their voice that I wanted to have heard, and not just the voice of the men in Israel. The second reason was that I believed that we women might have something of an advantage over the men, or at least a more promising starting point than our male colleagues when it came to dialogue with the Palestinians. What we saw in mixed dialogues in the 1980s, for example, was that, of course, men dominated, but also that the starting point was very different. For the Palestinians saw in the Israeli man in dialogue the soldier with the gun. The Israelis saw in the Palestinian man the terrorist with the bomb. These were the enemy writ large. As women, we did not have that kind of initial barrier. And it was my hope that actually, as women, we would have something of a bond, a mutuality as women. We might be on opposite sides of the conflict. We might be completely loyal and avid supporters of our own national rights, but we could exchange glances over male chauvinist, sexist comments from whatever side they might have come. We could exchange comments over our double careers. We could talk about our daughters. I'll give you an example that one of my colleagues would kill me for giving you. We were at a dialogue, a very meeting, high-ranking Israeli and Palestinian women, and one of my Israeli colleagues came late to one of the sessions in this three-day intensive dialogue. Why did she come late? Her 11-year-old daughter had just gotten her first period. Of course, she had to stick around and take care of things. This was an immediate icebreaker. Palestinian-Israeli made no difference as we women began to talk about our daughters, what it meant to reach enter adolescence, reaching womanhood amongst our daughters. This was a bond. This was an opening that was, of course, particular to women. I'll give you one other personal example. I was driving home one day from the university. I was driving through East Jerusalem, Palestinian side of Jerusalem. And I was stopped at a red light, and I was the first car. And a pedestrian crossed the street. It was a woman, a Palestinian woman, with her head covered. She was a religious woman. And she was pushing a baby stroller. And I looked down at the baby and totally involuntarily smiled because the baby was so cute. And then I looked up, and our eyes met, and we both just smiled. And there was an extraordinary, very powerful and emotional moment for me as they made this contact, because it was a very clear human contact. This was not the enemy. This was not the demonized enemy that we had experienced over all the years. We were just human beings. We were just women. We were just mothers, if you will, responding. This is not a totally simple matter, of course, finding a common ground, a meeting ground, in our interest as women, in our belief in women's rights, in our feminism. It's not an easy relationship between nationalism, the national struggle, and feminism, which should take priority, one might ask. Can they be achieved together? Questions that are more pressing, perhaps, for the Palestinian women, since Israeli women already have their national independence. But these are difficult questions, I think, and complicated issues. We did find that being women made a difference. It made a difference in our actions, in our positions, and in our effectiveness. Clearly, there were differences in behavior. The mixed dialogues always began adversarially, with the recitations of the history of political wrongs that had been done over the years. This is a mixed dialogues. Women's dialogues always began emotionally, with personal stories, highly emotional personal stories, so that instead of setting a framework of argument and adversarial positions, the women's dialogues always open by setting the stage for empathy and contact. Maybe this is proof of theories of Nancy Chodorow and Carol Gilligan, for those of you who know feminist theory. An element of trust and friendship beyond the purely political contact also evolved. Without idealizing, I think that we achieved a greater sense of working together, trusting the other side, a greater sense of trust than could be found amongst the men involved in dialogue. But it was not only behavior, I think our positions developed differently as well. As Israeli women, we went further than our male counterparts in the positions that we took. We were willing, and still are willing, to take more, perhaps radical positions than the men. To take the position, for example, in the 1980s, calling for speaking, negotiating with the PLO, calling for a Palestinian state, more recently calling for Jerusalem as a shared capital, the capital for two states. Positions that the mixed groups and the men eventually take, or took. But we were there first, in a sense. One could explain it by saying, that is the fact that we were there first, is that this was a result of our having less power than the men, and therefore people paid much less attention to us. In other words, we had less to lose among our own public, so that we could perhaps afford to be less cautious and less moderate. I think this is probably a relatively cynical interpretation of saying, since no one's going to pay attention to us, we could say anything we wanted. But in any case, I think that it may be that women were simply more straightforward about this, much less posturing to be done. No time, really, to stop and think about just how careful we had to be in which position we took, which also, of course, may be explained by our powerlessness. And that brings me to the issue of effectiveness, if indeed women are powerless. And in Israeli society, women are relatively powerless. Fewer than 10% of women in the Knesset, in the Parliament of Israel, that is less than 10% of the members of Parliament, are women. We have only one woman in the cabinet today in Israel. We had no women in the Israeli negotiating teams during all the negotiations before and after the Oslo Accords. So our effectiveness, I think, has been and can be at the grassroots level. That is creating an awareness among the public, giving voice to the second sex, to the citizens of the country, putting issues out there and drawing attention to the problems and to the issues that could ultimately be translated into numbers and ultimately into pressure on the government. And this is what I see again today. Similar to the days of the Intifada, women are again demonstrating. There are new groups cropping up, vigils, some on the basis, once again, of motherhood, but once again trying to get the message across. We are no less affected than men by the violence and losses that will come with the next war. And we, perhaps even more than the men, are aware of the untenability, the injustice of depriving people of their rights. And the common call of the women demonstrating every week, once again, today in Israel, is that peace based on compromise, on mutual understanding, and the rights of both peoples is possible and must be achieved. And more specifically, that peace is the only means to security. This is not the message of women alone in Israel, but it is the message of a large number of women, I dare say the majority of women, that this is the message that we are struggling to convey. Today it is not just left-wing women who are saying these things, by now the customary women demonstrators, but it is also women who were previously on the right, moderate right-wing voters in the past. It is also a very large number of young women. And I think the reason is in part the letdown, the enormous disappointment because of the breakdown in the peace process. That is a breakdown following a period of great hope, a period when we saw that peace was coming, a period when we could believe for the first time that the Arab-Israeli conflict of so many years was actually going to end, and the youngsters entering the army would not have to fight. It is the contrast, the letdown, with this hopeful period and today to see that this is gone. That's what I think has spurred many more women to action. And it is also the sense of impending doom, the heavy feeling that war is around the corner, if not all-out war in the very near future, at the least violent uprising and more bloodshed. And there's a third factor connected with this, the feeling that all this is happening in a situation over which we have no control. Decisions are being made above by the men, and our fate is thus being decided without our input. Increasingly, therefore, Israeli women are rejecting the passive role assigned to women in matters of war and security. And this is what has spurred women once again to weekly vigils throughout the country and swell the ranks of the peace movements. It is almost a desperate cry to our government, to our male leaders, a cry to them to abandon pride and macho gamesmanship, to make them understand that compromise is not weakness, that understanding and empathy will not impair their masculinity, and that human life, human dignity, and justice are far more important than another few square kilometers of land, particularly when we have seen most clearly that these kilometers, this territory, have not and will not bring us security. I don't think you have to be a woman to see this, and as I've said, it is not the message of women alone, but it is the message that women, finding their voices, are seeking to convey in women's groups and together with men, forming the majority of all Israelis today. It has become an imperative. Peace has become an imperative because the alternative is no longer acceptable. Thank you.